Hi, I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to a new episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis on the State of Affairs in Israel and the Jewish World. There's a lot to talk about on today's episode, and I'm joined by three media experts. The first is Natasha Hasdorf. She is a barrister based in London, and she is also a director at the UK Lawyers for Israel. Natasha has been doing a fantastic job at defending Israel in the British media. You can find her on Sky News and BBC, and really putting up an amazing stalwart defense of the state of Israel in the British media. So I strongly recommend, after you listen to Natasha on this episode, check her out on YouTube or on social media, because she really is one of the better defenders today of Israel in the international media. I'm then joined by two of my JPPI colleagues who really have an interesting perspective of what's happening in the media, by Noah Slepkov and Dana Van Luzon. We're going to talk about what's going on with the media bias. We're going to look also at the way the Israeli media has been covering this war, including the current and ongoing crisis with the United States and Europe. So we got a lot to deal with. First, the interview with Natasha, then we're going to go to Dana and Noah. Here we go. Natasha, it's great to have you on the JPPI podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
So you have been really a major defender of Israel since this whole war broke out. You've had amazing appearances, I have to say, in the British media. I think you've become something of a celebrity here in Israel. People enjoy watching you and seeing you and hearing what you have to say. But I wanted to start with you at the highest level of just like this media bias that we're all seeing. I mean, how bad would you say it is in this conflict compared to others in the past?
Well, so first of all, I really appreciate the kind words. I've always seen myself as a defender of the truth and the reality of the situation, especially against the increasing levels of misreporting. Unfortunately, we've been seeing stepping up enormously since the 7th of October. But in that context, the trend, I think, that we've experienced certainly decades previous to this, has been turbocharged. The false allegations, the blood libels that we've seen gain so much credence in mainstream media, has reached unprecedented levels. And in that context, in that respect, it does seem that someone like me, standing up and just reporting the facts and the law as they are, is something of an anomaly and something that doesn't seem to have been particularly welcome in the context of the narrative and the agenda that we have otherwise seen the major broadcasters pursuing. It's deeply, deeply unfortunate, but I think it makes it even more important, vitally so, that there are more commentators who, armed with an understanding of the facts and the situation, are prepared to call out those falsehoods.
But what do you think? I mean, there's a lot of talk, obviously, especially among Jewish communities in the diaspora, of where this bias comes from. You know, is it ignorance? Is it lack of education? Or is it just a foundation of anti-Semitism? I'm curious from your experience how you view that.
I see it as a combination of all of those factors. Certainly, unfortunately, in terms of the bookers and the journalists that are setting the agenda, many of them of a younger generation are those that get their news increasingly from TikTok, from other social media outlets. And we've seen that combined with NGO networks that are set up, funded in order to promote an anti-Israel false agenda against the Jewish state. They often provide the commentators and the so-called experts that are then interviewed by those very young journalists and bookers. We've seen the impact, of course, also of the academy and the absence, unfortunately, of freedom of speech and free debate as regards Israel, the received wisdom that Israel is an ethnically cleansing colonial occupier, and the promotion again of those blood libels without opposition. I mean, all of that creates, I'm afraid to say, a perfect storm. And in that context, it becomes, certainly there are elements of groupthink that enter into that equation, but it becomes exceedingly difficult if you are someone who's seeking to point out those falsehoods. You are definitely pushing against the tide, and that is a tide that will sweep you up towards promotion and accolades, and becoming part of, you know, the journalistic or academic good guys. So, you know, increasingly, I think it's harder for people to push back against that. And we've seen the effects of that. I mean, we've seen extraordinary examples, haven't we? Even Jeremy Bowen, when it was proven that the reporting by the BBC had been deeply, deeply irresponsible with respect to the 17th of October Al-Akhli hospital strike, turned out, of course, to be a Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket that fell in the car park of the hospital. It had been reported as though it was an Israeli airstrike targeting the hospital. The fact that Jeremy Bowen couldn't bring himself to apologise or to actually acknowledge that he had been mistaken or to show remorse for that, I think is symptomatic of where the flock of journalists that are following him have inevitably moved to. I was extremely intrigued by Matti Friedman's analysis of his own experiences many, many years ago now, reporting from Jerusalem as part of the Associated Press. And he started already to point out the trends of, you know, editorial policy on Israel, of publishing what was expected to sell newspapers and to make headlines, whether or not it had any bearing on the reality of the situation. He pointed that out, as I say, many, many years ago, and those trends have compounded and they've become even more forceful since the 7th of October.
I've noticed that one of the things you do in your interviews is you often refer to international law, and you talk about how Israel is actually meeting the criteria and abiding by international law. Now, people hear that, it's a hard argument to counter because they're just talking populistic or, you know, slogans of, oh, but you're killing this or you're doing that. I mean, it's something that you feel is impactful and having the right kind of influence over people and making them understand what's really happening.
Well, whether it's impactful or not, you'll have to tell me. But I think it's critical because one of the casualties, especially over the last few months, has been international law, the way it has been misrepresented, misreported, abused even vis-a-vis Israel. And we've seen this not only in the media, but also in the context of international legal institutions, in the International Court of Justice, in the International Criminal Court, and also across UN bodies and in, for example, the UN Human Rights Council and in the General Assembly. These are false allegations, both in terms of the facts and the law against Israel. And it is not just a twisting, but in fact an inversion of international law, where one actually accuses the victims of the genocidal acts perpetrated by Hamas on the 7th of October, accuses those victims of committing genocide, or accuses Israel, which, you know, we're talking about a state and an army that conducts itself in armed conflict in an unprecedented fashion, not just meeting the requirements of the laws of war, but exceeding them in so many respects across the board, something that is recognized by other law-abiding militaries, something that was even recognized by US spokespeople who said America being placed in a similar position to Israel probably wouldn't be in a position to take the measures that Israel has taken to prevent civilian casualties, to target strikes, and to precisely go after terrorist infrastructure in this fashion. All of that, of course, is completely lost when you have these false allegations of war crimes being leveled. And I think the reason that people are able to get away with this populist abuse of international law is because general levels of literacy on what international law says about these issues are remarkably low. And so there isn't the ability for individuals if they're not lawyers, and especially even if they are lawyers, if they don't necessarily have very much experience of how international law works, there isn't really the ability to push back, to challenge the falsehoods that are being so widely propagated. And so I think it's vital because Israel is a country of law and order. It is a country that prizes the rule of law. And in so many respects, especially in the region, in the Middle East, it is a shining beacon of law. And as we've seen even before the 7th of October, in the constitutional debacle vis-a-vis the legal reforms, allegations that Israel is lacking in democratic robustness or lacking in an ability to uphold and apply the law, these are felt very keenly by ordinary Israelis. It's something that really hits home. And especially when it's untrue, it ultimately requires the most robust and I think the highest challenge possible.
You know, I've also seen in interviews that you've done, you often talk about something that I like to talk about and write about as well, which is the whole, these fallacies when it comes to the death casualty toll. And while every loss of civilian life, I think we'll both agree, is a tragedy, we could talk about who's responsible for it as a separate issue. But the way the international media and even world leaders, President Biden, the British Prime Minister, the head of WHO, the World Health Organization, everybody just accepts these numbers as if they're coming from the Palestinian Health Ministry. I watched that interview you had the other day, the panel on Sky News, where you were talking about it, and you were saying to them, and the woman who you were, Rachel Shalby, I think, who was saying, no, the Palestinian Health Ministry, they're accurate. They should be believed. And it's like, excuse me, this is Hamas. You would never say the same thing about ISIS or Al-Qaeda. How is it that when it comes to Hamas, it's acceptable?
Well, what an indictment on journalism and on these journalists, these international colleagues of yours. I'm sorry to say.
I'm sad to say. I agree, and it I find it to be abhorrent. I mean, you mentioned, sorry to interrupt, you mentioned the hospital incident, right? I mean, the fact that the New York Times, BBC, everybody, CNN, all report verbatim what a Hamas organization says, a terrorist group that decapitates, rapes, and murders children, men, and women. And they say that Israel has killed 500 people in a strike. The example that I came up with is, could you imagine after 9/11, as America's bombing the Tora Bora cave complex, where they thought bin Laden was, and suddenly the Al-Qaeda health ministry claims that America has killed 500 people. Do we really think that the New York Times would report that? Of course not. But what's wrong? What they wouldn't do there, for some reason here, is okay. And it there's something deeply disturbing.
Well, if we're talking about basic journalistic standards, I mean, with respect to Al-Akhli, it really wouldn't have required much for someone, one of their local on-the-ground members of the bureau or stringers, to have walked down the street and to have seen with their own eyes that the hospital was intact and that this, in fact, was, first of all, a rocket that was one that ultimately landed in the car park, but then to have thought through the practicalities of this, acknowledge that Israel does not target civilian objects, think through the fact that Palestinian and Islamic Jihad and Hamas rockets frequently fall short in the Gaza Strip. Think through the fact that they have a track record, these terrorists, of keeping weapons caches next to protected buildings like hospitals, and actually just apply basic common sense and analysis before launching into, as you say, repeating the Hamas propaganda angle on this. And absolutely, we've seen that with respect to the casualty figures. And because they have been so wholeheartedly embraced by the international media, we've also seen, I think, increasing pressure by responsible, I'd say otherwise responsible governments in repeating these figures. Quite apart from some very interesting open source analysis, which has been done on the veracity of the individual figures and suggestions that because of the very conforming manner in which the casualties are said to rise on a daily basis, there's something really quite suspicious there. So quite apart from the veracity of the numbers, which we simply cannot independently verify, the two critical pieces of information which are never, ever addressed when these figures are put out is that we do not know how these casualties are said to have been caused, whether they in fact result from Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad rockets which are falling short in the Gaza Strip, whether they are as a result of Hamas shooting or bombing their own civilians. And we've seen examples of that when civilians have been seeking to flee according to the humanitarian corridors that Israel has laid down, shooting those civilians so that they are intimidated and remain as human shields as much as possible. And the other aspect of the missing information here is this distinction between civilians and combatants, which, although to a certain extent was identified in previous operations, even by Hamas, previous operations in Gaza, here they have been at great pains essentially to present every single casualty in the Gaza Strip as a civilian casualty. Now, we know that Israel has identified in the region of 12,000 terrorists that it has killed. These are not accounted for in the Hamas numbers. And we also know that when one actually does compare the casualty ratio of civilians and combatants elsewhere in the world and, you know, what we can glean to the best of our understanding in this situation, they're incomparable. The United Nations puts out statistics that say, you know, the global average in terms of urban armed conflict, which is a very challenging, complex form of armed conflict, especially in an asymmetrical context where you're fighting a terrorist organization which embeds itself within civilian communities. But even outside of that context and looking at urban armed conflict generally, the UN's average is a very disturbing 9 civilians to every 1 combatant. In Afghanistan and Iraq, the statistics put out by the Americans are also a disturbing 5-1 and 3-1, respectively. Even if we take on board the Hamas casualty figures as they're put out, you know, despite all of the qualifications that I already outlined, and compare them against the casualties that Israel knows to attribute to terrorists, we're looking at below 2-1. Right, Netanyahu suggested a few weeks ago that we would be looking at 1-1. My own back of the envelope calculations a few weeks ago indicated it was something like 1.6-1. But in any event, we're looking at below 1-1. And taking into account that Hamas's modus operandi here is to drive up the civilian death toll, either through inflated fictitious figures or through, and we have to acknowledge, of course, that this is happening, civilians dying in the Gaza Strip, because of Hamas tactics, because of their desire, it seems, to increase the civilian death toll as much as possible in order to put international pressure on Israel to cease its operation. Because let's face it, this is the only hope Hamas has of remaining and surviving. And that is its key aim here, to survive this operation. And it does so by driving up that casualty count, by generating this propaganda. And it is being assisted in that aim by media institutions and governments that are putting out these false figures and that are continuing to drive and pile up the pressure on Israel to cease its entirely lawful self-defense.
Yeah, this is one of the more disturbing aspects of this conflict, without a doubt. Natasha, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the JPPI podcast. Thank you for your time, and thank you for all the work that you do on behalf of Israel. Thank you. So, Noah, I want to start with you. We just heard from Natasha talking a lot about just this bias, this foundation that I describe more as anti-Semitic that you see today in the media. And I think that we can call it that without a doubt. So when you look at what's happening, and, you know, you and I were kind of talking a little earlier, it's not just in the mainstream media. We're seeing this also by, you know, the late night shows and the comics assorted. We saw it at the Oscars, obviously, with Glazer, the director of Zone of Interest, but also with who was it who was wearing the bloody hands, right? And whatever, famous stars. You know, this is obviously crossing throughout all different verticals. You know, how do you view just how severe the situation is right now?
Well, look, I don't need to tell you about what sells newspapers, but the saying "if it bleeds, it leads" is a good is a good indicator of what's going on. And the story, the simple story of, oh, people in Gaza are dying, children are dying, they're fighting Israel, therefore it must be Israel's fault, is a simple, easy narrative, especially when you have, this ceasefire now type of philosophy that people, it's hard to understand. Well, why, you know, what's the problem? Ceasefire now. That seems like such a simple request. Like, who would be against a ceasefire? And of course, you know, the small print, what's a ceasefire? A ceasefire is a period of time in which Hamas rearms and decides when to strike Israel again. I mean, there was a ceasefire on October 6th, but it didn't prevent the atrocities on October 7th. So I think the story is so simple from, if you don't dig deeper, that it's just people are kind of, they're driven by the story, and that's what they see. And you see it on the late night shows that, you know, John Oliver, for example, he'll always do something at the very beginning of his episode that is attacking the fact that the war is still going on and America's not stopping it. And so you see this quite all over the place, in all the places, in all the media.
You know, one of the things, though, Donna, is, and I always remember, I try to keep this in mind, because we Israelis and Jews love to complain about Israel's PR and public diplomacy. But I think that what people tend to forget is that as good as PR is or can be, it can't cover up for policies that are not good policies. And I say that in the context of just everything that's happening right now, that seems that Israel has this bit of a fight and a spat with the United States. We are being accused of not presenting and articulating what it is that we want to see happen in Gaza and the day after this war. Things seem to be a bit stuck on the ground in Gaza. There's still some fighting in the central Gaza Strip, some fighting in northern Gaza, but, you know, the whole Rafah thing, is it happening? Is it not happening? We keep on threatening it's going to happen, but it hasn't happened. And the hostage deal, is that going to happen or is it not going to happen? In other words, the question really is not PR, I always think. It's also, what are the government's policies?
Well, I have so much to say. First, I will answer what you're asking, but I also want to say something about what Noach said when he said this is the simple story. And it's remind me, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, you know, Program 1, Program 2. And I think that's right, because I think people are more easy just, okay, what's going with the war? Oh, these are the bad guys, these are the good guys, and that's it. They're not digging, you know, thinking slow and trying to understand the whole story, because it's a complicated story. The situation is complicated. So you're just trying to do the good and the bad guys. And when I'm talking about, and you're saying, you know, the PR, or yes, the situation is complicated. And it's true. We are living in Israel and we don't know what's going on, or what is the next step? What is the ending game? When it's going to end? Who is going to end? And how it's going to end? So the situation, the way it looks like, it's really like a frozen moment. And I don't think it looks good from the outside. So I think the criticism from United States or other countries, if they want to criticize what we're doing, I think they are right. And I think in order to change what the world is thinking about Israel is not just to say they don't understand, or, you know, to make excuses. One way to change the way people think about you is like making some psychological intervention, is to be self-criticized. I think our media is very one-way narrative. We don't even show what's going on in Gaza. So if we want people not to create stories about what we are doing there, send television into Gaza, show the world how we really treat well the Gaza citizens, not just say that, show that. So don't let them you know, invent things. And even if you are making some mistakes, because this is war and it's a very ugly game, and sometimes things are happening which you didn't want them to happen, take responsibility about that. I think this is the way we will look more, you know, balanced, and not just show one thing, one way of the story, our perspective. I think we need to think how, and this is something from the beginning of the war, I don't see images from Gaza. It's like, there's nothing here. And I think it doesn't look good.
Yeah, so no, I do. I did want to. So, I mean, what do you think of the way, and more broadly speaking, you know, just playing off what Dana was talking about, what do you think about the way the Israeli media has been covering this?
Well, I think as someone who's, you know, I grew up in Canada, and I watch a lot of television from Canada, from the United States, and now I'm mostly watching Israeli media and a lot of CNN, and I think what's so striking to me. From October 7th at, you know, 7:30 in the morning, for 2 weeks, the Israeli mm-hmm. news channel, which I watch, Channel 12, it didn't take a single commercial break. There were, for 2 weeks, like 24-hour news coverage, uninterrupted. It's like when you're at a casino when there are no windows and you have no sense of time. It was like that. And so I think that the... I disagree with Donna. I do think that I've seen a lot of media stories in the Israeli army has been taking in journalists into Gaza. And I think what's really almost comical is how Daniel Agari, the spokesperson for the army, it's like he can't lie. Like he takes a camera crew to a bunker that has like a chair with ropes next to it. And he says, we think they might have hostages here, but I can't prove it, so I'm not going to say it. And it's like, you know, in what world would you have an army showing you a chair with blood next to it and ropes around it, and not even, like, let's say he couldn't prove it. He could just say the hostages were here, and no one would be wiser. And I think that while people are like criticizing the Israeli army, and, you know, when you read in the New York Times, everything is couched in he said, they said, you know, according to the Gaza Ministry of Health, there's this many dead. And, you know, they'll be in a tunnel in underneath a hospital in Gaza, and they'll say, according to the Israelis, this is a tunnel underneath a hospital. And it's like, you're there. Like, you know, you really don't want to take a side here. And the Israeli army doesn't help in the fact that they really aren't saying anything that they can't say is true. And you have this problem with the allege that the 500 people were killed in the parking in the hospital. You know, to count dead bodies, it's you know, in Israel, it took us, I think, 5-6 days to get to the body count of 1,400. And then they started saying, okay, it was 1,200 because there was, you know, they miscalculated. But for after that, when there was an incident in the parking lot of the hospital, and right away they said there were 500 dead, and the New York Times published, I remember seeing the headlines, 500 people dead in hospital attack. And the Israeli army didn't say this is a lie from the beginning. They said, we're investigating this, because they didn't want to be in a situation where they could have said something that would be deemed untrue. And it seems like the whole mission of the army spokes office this war has been not to say anything that could be proven untrue. And even when, you know, you have hostages that are killed in Gaza, no one can prove that Hamas didn't kill the hostages. Israel could just say Hamas killed these hostages, and it's Hamas's fault. For the Israeli army to come out and say, we killed these hostages by friendly fire, or there was an incident, it's like crazy. Like, what more proof do you need that this army is not lying about what's happening? So I think the fact that they're so focused on telling the truth and not lying, they kind of lose the media battle when Hamas has absolutely no complete disregard for facts. Oh, a hostel was bombed. Well, it was actually a parking lot, and it was a Palestinian rocket, but it doesn't matter. Like, this, you know, they'll say whatever will get the headline.
I think that the fact that we are so much taking like over care about the truth and trying not to say something. If we are not 100% sure, I think this is a way to keep us, you know, not crazy or not be a Hamas, a terror organization. We are trying to keep ourselves a democracy, a country with a self-respect and responsibility. And we are dealing with a group of people which are terrorists. And I think the way to keep ourselves not drawing to be crazy like them, this is maybe the overreacting, the overdoing that what's happened to us. That's also a thinking after what you said.
Yeah, I mean, I'm proud of the fact that they can't tell a lie. It's comical in the, like, how far Daniel Hagari will go not to say anything that he can't prove 100% as fact.
I mean, you know, the question that we have to ask ourselves is, you know, and I think we all do see this to some extent, Israel is evaluated and judged differently than Hamas. So the moment, you know, they lie, people continue to accept their lies even the next day. We lie one time, you can be sure that they will not take anything that we say. They don't take anything that we say anyhow, right? They don't believe it as it is. So imagine what will happen. They'll catch us with the lie. I mean, I even today I saw like an Al Jazeera tweet somewhere referring to some claim that had been made by United Hatzalah at some point, like a medical emergency organization during the war, about a baby that was cut out of the womb of the mother and then put in an oven or something like that, and how it was never true and it was false, whatever the case may be. But these are all things that, you know, Israel can't be caught lying once, and our enemy, their MO is always to lie. The other thing that I'll just say is when it comes to public relations for a country like Israel, we do have, and it's important for people to recognize, we have an inherent built-in handicap, and that is the structure of our government. And it's often overlooked, and it's as if only we had better spokespeople, or only we had better policies, or only we had, you know, better people who could speak better English. No. That's not the issue. Part of the issue, and here's just the simplest example, is when we have a prime minister who says, for example, no, we don't plan on resettling the Gaza Strip with Israeli settlements. But then you have two senior ministers of his government who go to a convention hall and not only say different, but dance with people at a conference calling for the resettlement of Gaza. So you're, forget about some Biden administration official or someone at the Elysee Palace in Paris who's watching this, but you're an average American who sees this and you're saying, what's going on?
I think, Yaakov, you're saying something very important, because you're taking a different perspective. Me and Noach are saying it's so difficult to deal the war when you are having in the other side, not a country, a terror organization. So the rules of the games that we play and they play are completely different. And we know that lie is much more stronger than the truth. And you are saying, this is not the only problem we have, because our enemy is a terror organization and not a country, a democratic country. It's a completely different story. We also have a problem inside the country.
Well, no, with the structural problem, anyone who's ever worked in PR, and I've been on the opposite end, the receiving end of PR for many, you know, for over two decades as a journalist, but one of the most important things, for example, in crisis communications is the unified message. So if I have a crisis in my organization and everybody is talking to the media, we're all going to be saying something else. You have to control what you're saying, and you have to have a clear and unified message. Now, in Israel, because of the structure of our government, like, you know, the one thing I always say is, like, in America, Pete Buttigieg, who's the Mayor Pete, right, the Secretary of Transportation, he's not going to talk about the Gaza Strip. It's got nothing to do with his portfolio. If he talks about the war with Hamas, he would probably say something. He'll be so neutral, and he'll make sure that whatever he says is in line with whatever the president's message is, right? Because he serves at the pleasure of the president, and he doesn't deal with foreign policy, right? There's clear distinction. Here, our Secretary of Transportation, our Minister of Transportation, Miri Regev, will say whatever she wants about anything, right? So, you know, that's how you have a situation where anybody can say whatever they want, and that creates a very mixed environment of messaging that is not conducive for trying to explain and articulate what you're trying to do to the world. I want to wrap up, but before I do, I want to ask each of you very quickly, if you have one piece of advice which you could give right now to the Israeli government of how we can maybe improve this messaging, what would it be? So Dana, let's start with you and then go to Noah.
I will bring viewers from the outside and will take them with me into Gaza with cameras and let them tell the world what they see.
Noah?
Well, first I would have them reinstall our previous guest on our podcast, Ayalon Levy, back to his position as a spokesperson, because everyone agrees that he's fantastic. I think the three of us probably all know him well personally here. So that would be the first thing. But I think that what you were talking about at this the start about policies and affecting, I mean, they really need to articulate a day after scenario that a Palestinian can listen to and say, you know what? I could live with that. That's a situation I can live with. And until we show them what it is we want to provide them when this war is over, the everything else is irrelevant, because the day after is for the Palestinians, it's the most important thing. And if we don't articulate our end goal here, what is the Gaza Strip going to look like in 5 years? And this is our target that we're trying to achieve. People think it's a war of choice and not a war of necessity.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find all our episodes where you get your podcasts. Please share widely and give us a 5-star review. We will see you back here soon.